Ted and Jeff and John are the three horsemen. They never get along, they're the three horsemen. They argue about science fiction and fantasy. Fred and Jeff and John are the three horsemen. Ride, horsemen, ride.
Good evening and welcome to the Three Horsemen podcast. My name is John Stevens and I am one of the Three Horsemen. I believe I am Criticism, the Horseman of Criticism. And let me first introduce everyone who's here on the podcast with us tonight. First of all, one of my co-hosts, Jeff Patterson. Oh, wait, that's right. He's not here. He'll be along shortly. Don't worry, folks. So let's go to Fred Kish.
Good evening. This is Fred Kish, and I guess I am the horseman of administrative duties. I can be found on Twitter as Fred Kish, and I blog at Bernal, B-E-R-N-A-L, Alpha.
And truly, Fred is the most dangerous horseman of all. Moving on, we have two fantabulous guests tonight.
Returning guests.
Right? They're both returning. Both of them are suckers. I mean, you know, friends of the show. Thrilled to be here. Thank you. Well, let's start with you, Jonah.
I'm Jonah Sutton Morse. I have a podcast, Cabbages and Kings. I am trying not to be on Twitter at King Cabbage Cast as much, but it's not working out very well. So that's often where I am.
Alrighty. And Kate?
I'm Kate Sherrod. I guess I'm the token horsewoman. possibly horsewoman of research. I don't know. That's what I've been doing mostly today. I am a poet. I've got a new book just out. We'll talk about later in the show. And a fiction writer and a speech and debate coach and sometimes podcaster. I am one of the incredible dorks on Skiffy and Fandy's Thrawn and On and On. Which is a Star Wars literary podcast, which is kind of on hiatus right now, but I hope we get it going again soon.
Excellent.
So, and a huge fan of tonight's author.
Yes.
Tonight's author is one of my favorites, most definitely. And just to wrap up everything, my name, of course, as I said, is John Stevens, and I am a writer, critic, bookseller person, and I am most often to be found on Twitter at Erudite Ogre, and I occasionally write stuff hither and thither, and hopefully some of my short stories will be in the hot hands of editors very soon. All right.
Don't sound so enthusiastic there, John.
Editors are so mean. No. So tonight we are going to begin one of what is probably a long series of discussions on one of the greatest writers, at least of the 20th, 21st century. I say he straddles both centuries like a titan. And that is Jorge Luis Borges. And he is, you know, very well known around the world. He was born in Argentina in 1899. And he grew up there. And when he was a teenager, he moved to Switzerland with his family. And then he sort of bummed around Europe for a few years, came back to Buenos Aires in 1921. And a few years later, he began to write. It took him a little while to get going. It was about 1935, I believe, is when Universal History of Infamy came out. And for his day job, he became a librarian, briefly. But the call of fiction just never really got out of him after he started. So he went on to have a long and fairly illustrious career as a writer of fictions. Very specifically short stories. That was the form that he was utterly passionate about, and he once, to paraphrase, he once said that, you know, why write a novel for 50,000 words when you can say the same thing in two pages? That was his creed that he used, and even though some of his stories are longer than that, he has really proven, I think, with his fiction, that you can do a lot in a little space. You can stimulate a dissertation with a couple of paragraphs. And what we're going to do tonight is we're going to begin by talking about a few of his more well-known stories, and sort of as an introduction, and sort of as a way to get a feel for his work in general, and maybe talk a bit about how it relates to each of our perspectives as readers and creators, and also how it relates to perhaps the field of Fantastica in general. We'll see how we get. We may just get one paragraph into Tlan. We don't know. So the first thing I wanted to do was to ask each of the panelists how they encountered Borges, and what that encounter did for them in terms of, did it change the way you thought about fiction? Did it give you particular ideas that were useful to you subsequently, etc.? And let's start with Kate.
Okay. I'm from Wyoming, and not exactly a literary hotbed. So I didn't actually encounter Borges until college. I went to Bard College in Annandale, New York. And sophomore year, I took a course, Forms of Modern Fiction. And we read all kinds of modern and postmodern stuff. We read Kurt Vonnegut. We read Gabriel Garcia Marquez. We read Thomas Pynchon. And we read Jorge Luis Borges. And we read everything in the collection Labyrinths, both the fiction and the nonfiction. And the very first story of his that I ever read was the first story that we want to talk about tonight, which is Tlun Akbar Orbis Tertius. And my first reaction to that was, oh my God, I found the companion volume to my favorite book of all time, which is Umberto Eco's Foucault's Pendulum. I was like, okay, this is the missing piece. And my second reaction was, where's the story? And my third reaction was, who needs a story when you've got all of this cool stuff? And my fourth reaction was to look up all of the names of all of the other Argentinian writers that Borges Tuckerized into this story. And I wound up spending about a year reading as many of them as I could find. And I fell down an Argentinian rabbit hole that I'm still very happily falling through.
Excellent. So what is it that struck you about Borges? What is it that sort of captivated you?
He wasn't afraid to show off what he knew, but he didn't take it too seriously. Right. He was obviously having fun. Mm-hmm. I've always liked writers that led me to new ideas and new things, and I realized there was more in a Borges short story to feed the research junkie in me than there was in most novels, especially the kind of novels that I was reading in college, because my next class was all of the books of Joseph Conrad. So I love the way it's kind of a capsule introduction to some of the more obscure bits of Western thought, and some Eastern thought too. If we get around to the Garden of Forking Paths, yep. Yeah, we start playing with a little Eastern mythology too. So, and he's truly someone that no matter how many times you read him, you find something new, you notice something new, or it connects to something else that you've read lately. Just today when I was looking through The Garden of Forking Paths again, I realized, you know, without the ideas there, we don't get Rick and Morty. So Borges connects to everything. I mean, we talk about how H.P. Lovecraft was the internet of his day. Right. I think Borges was maybe the Wikipedia. We could talk about that.
Yeah, there you go. No, and I think that's a good point that you made at the end about connectivity, because what the difference for me, I think, is that Lovecraft is sort of parroted and parodied, whereas Borges generates a lot more innovation and sort of discovery.
Mm-hmm. Well, and he'd be pretty hard to parody.
Yes.
You'd basically just write more Borges.
Right. How do you parody a guy who parodied Don Quixote?
You know? But if you were the one typing the exact same short story, if you were to retype Talon Ukbar, would it not be a new and brilliant story?
And richer.
Yeah. And richer.
Well, because exactly. I type using Dragon Naturally Speaking, so it would have a lot more curse words in it.
It's the raw version of Borges.
Yeah. Well, and didn't he have to dictate a lot after he went blind? So
he did.
It might actually be a reproduction of the original draft.
There you go.
No, damn it, that's not the word I wanted, except in Spanish, so it would be, no, puta! No es la palabra quiero. Anyway.
How about you, Jonah?
I also first encountered Borges in college, and very briefly in an Old English class, because at one point he taught himself Anglo-Saxon and waxed lyrical about the wonders of the language and what he loved about it. And then I took a class on science fiction and fantasy, and sandwiched between Dune and Lord of the Rings and Lovecraft was Ficciones. And I'm pretty sure it was specifically Talon and Garden of Forking Paths and Library of Babel and Circular Ruins that we started with. And I started reading fantasy with The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings, and for me, fantasy has been about world building and imagining worlds, and here were infinite ways and levels of worlds to imagine without any characters or plot to get in the way. And I have sort of been vaguely aware that I could fall down rabbit holes of finding all of his references, and that in some ways that would be very rewarding, because every once in a while I'll stumble on something I actually know, and I realize that that adds to my reading. And yet at the same time, I love reading these stories having almost no idea what is just Borges' imagination and what is another writer or another idea that he's playing with, and how much is fact and how much is fiction. And that seems to be so much of what's going on in these stories, is just the kind of infinite possibilities and the ways that boundaries and definitions blur. And so it's always just wonderful to go back, because I get all of the world building I could ever want. I mean, who needs novels when you have Borges short stories? And and then you can go wandering for days and days.
Right. Yeah, that pure world building, I think, was part of the attraction for me. Like you said, bereft of characters and plot and pretty much stripped of almost everything else. It is really like essential world building. It's like setting up the ontology of the world, and setting up the physical, scientific rules and the physical rules of the world. I definitely resonate with that aspect of what you're talking about. Hey Fred.
Hey John.
What's up?
Well, I think
with you and Borges.
I had first encountered him in a collection. Unfortunately, I've never been able to locate it again, but they had Library of Babel in it. It was a paperback science fiction collection, which Internet Speculative Fiction Database has failed me on because I just can't find it anywhere. And then I kind of encountered them sideways in an article in Newsweek about H.P. Lovecraft, which talked about there was this the one edition that came out from Ballantine in the 1970s, all with those matching covers of like the rat face with the tail going through the eye sockets, and the lurking fear one with the blue skulls and the, you know, so it talks about him being a fan of Lovecraft. And after that, I encountered him on occasion, oddly enough, in conjunction with things like M.C. Escher, Heavy Metal, the magazine, and just, you know, weird things here and there. And then I started reading him several years ago. And then I think it was, 2 years ago, we kind of half-jokingly suggested, hey, we should do a podcast about Borges. Let's call it Borges Cast. And we've been trying to get this puppy off the ground ever since then. Mm-hmm. And what I like about him is, this is an echo of what everyone else has said, mostly the connectivity, which I see with other authors, them making fun of him or riffing off of him, but also the way he rips off of things in his from his time. And just the same sort of thing that Tim Powers does with the strange histories. You know, some stuff is real, some stuff is not. Encountering the name of a real bookseller who actually followed me for a brief time on Twitter in Toulon. That shop is still around. You know, and saying, looking it up, is that real? Is that a real thing? Is that a real thing? You know, just keep doing that. And, you know, then, you know, the echoes, again, over, let's say, to The Echo is an Echo. Foucault's Pendulum was mentioned, but also Name of the Rose, where one of the characters is Borges, as well as the labyrinth inside that book, or The Garden of Forking Paths in The Sandman Chronicles by Neil Gaiman. Or, I mean, you know, you just keep finding echoes of him all throughout literature. Mm-hmm. So that's what keeps me coming back. Read something and then try and find what it connects to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely that. I like that part. Also, I mean, just that, and the idea that I see that keeps coming out in all of our sort of discourses on what we like is that seems to be one of the stronger elements is that there's so much possibility. And he stimulates, but he like stimulates further, not only introspection but also imagination outward, and it really seems to be infectious. It's like his stories are little vectors that infect you with the imagination virus.
You can see, for me, this is what has always happened with me with Arthur C. Clarke. Clarke would put these introductions or afterwards in his books, and he would talk about pentominoes or fractals or any number of things. And I would go out and I would buy all the books I could find about pentominoes and fractals. And that would lead to other fiction which mentioned that, or other nonfiction. So it's, you know, it's kind of like having a conversation with the author, but the author's also teaching you and leading to new worlds. And
yeah.
Those are the authors I keep coming back to.
Yeah, because I remember I also had a class on Ulysses in college. And I know that there are people who love Ulysses, and I know that I could put energy into Ulysses and find ways to love it. But
that'll be on our next podcast.
But
try it as an audiobook sometime.
Maybe
the cheap ass Audible. There's like one that's only like $2 or $3.
Okay,
and it is so fun. that I actually, I liked it, but I didn't see why people loved it. And then I listened to the audiobook just last year, and I'm like, this is a blast.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, certainly one of the things Ulysses does well is language. But I remember taking the class, and basically the guy would stand up there, and chapter by chapter by chapter, he would explain all of the different references and all of the different things that Joyce was doing. And Joyce is riffing off of this and that, and here's the reference, et cetera, et cetera. And I felt really dumb.
Is there anything
right?
less
it was like, this is
like
all of the stuff that you have to know in order to appreciate. And with Borges, I feel really smart. I feel like he is teaching me different ways of thinking. Like when he's got that story in Talon about the number of coins and the discoveries.
Oh, yeah.
X crosses a deserted road and loses 9 copper coins. Y finds 4 coins, somewhat rusted by Wednesday's rain. Z discovers 3 more. X finds 2 more. And then explains the reality, the continuity of the 9 coins and how that is ridiculous and nonsense in Talon. Talon is a world in which you don't have cause and effect. And so saying something like somewhat rusted by Wednesday's rain is in fact heretical and
inexpressible in their language.
Yes. And it feels like I'm being invited to play games. Like Borges is saying, if you want, I can teach you to think about reality and the world in different ways, which is a lot of what happens with philosophy and kind of a lot of what happens with just kind of our systems of thought and behavior. And I feel like Borges is teaching me to think and to learn how to think and doing it in ways that are just continually surprising and delightful to me. And it's like, I don't know where you're going with this yet, but when we get to the end of this little rabbit hole, I'm going to smile and I'm also going to feel as though like I've learned something and both of those are really wonderful for me.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've actually found it whenever I've got an especially bright student on my hands, I'm a speech and debate coach. So I kind of attract the geeky ones anyway. But Borges is one of the best things to throw at a certain kind of student to make them understand that it's actually fun to be smart. And it's okay not to be the smartest one in the room. You can still have fun. Mm-hmm. You can be the dumbest one in the room and you'll still have fun if you've got the right company. Mm-hmm. And Borges and the people who love him are always the right company. I'm pretty sure I was the dumbest one in the room in that class. Mm-hmm. You know, I was just a little hick with you know, cow shit on my boots.
Right.
And Thomas Pynchon had broken my brain real bad. But then we got to Borges and I felt all better.
Yeah.
So what about you, John?
Well, Well, here's the thing. I first encountered Borges in high school.
Lucky you.
Yeah, well, the fortunate thing for me was that I was in the college prep history course, history track, and one of the teachers sort of latched onto me early on and sort of saw that I was super shy and smart, and he's actually the one who introduced me to science fiction. And he had bookcases full of SF and fantasy in his office. He had like one shelf of history books, and everything else was science fiction and fantasy. So, and that was a library he allowed certain students to borrow from. And one day I was looking for something different because one of the things that he had stimulated me was to search for different stuff. Like up until the point I met him, I was reading, you know, Burroughs and reading a lot of, you know, Howard and, you know, reading pulpy stuff and not broadening my range very much. And one of the things I actually got from those experiences of reading those books was that curiosity to explore further. And, you know, I told him I wanted something, you know, different to read. And he'd give me some great stuff previously, but I said, I really want something different. So he gave me the Aleph collection.
Ooh.
And said, try this. So I, you know, eagerly ran to the library during study period, because I never studied during study period. And, unless I went out for donuts. But,
mm-hmm.
I
used to pretend I was sick so that they'd send me inside the school library during recess.
That sounds familiar too. So I curled up in a chair and started reading, and in about 5 minutes later I was like, what is this? What the heck is this? And I put it down and I started to get upset, because 90% of what I'd read up to that point was really pretty standard fantasy fare. I'd read very little science fiction. I'd read some Heinlein, that was about it. But I had just finished reading an Ursula Le Guin book, The Left Hand of Darkness, before that. And I had heard through my instructor, my teacher, that this person, Borges, was an influence on a lot of people, including Le Guin. And I said, well, I guess I should give it another try. So I gave it another try, and I had to power through it for the first couple of sessions, just because I wasn't ready to take it the way it should be taken. I wanted to take it as like a regular fantasy story with a plot and characters and, you know, the heroic cycle and all that. And I just wasn't prepared for what it actually gave me. But after a couple of sessions, I began to see what was so great about it. And that's, you know, one of the encounters with books I had as a high school student that really, I think, changed my thinking about everything.
You realize there wasn't just pulp fiction, there was pulp philosophy too.
Right. And there also wasn't linearity, and there also wasn't, mm-hmm. like, it just suddenly opened up a whole lot of avenues. And I think along the lines of what Jonah said, it also made you feel pretty smart. And that's what I liked about the science fiction I'd read to that point, was that it always made you feel smart, because it either explained the scientific concepts or it presented them in the story in a way that you could grasp them. So having that transported into the fantasy, sort of the fantasy perspective for me, was a big thing. And I actually started to look at fantasy work a little differently too, and to broaden my my fantasy reading. So Borges was a part of this process, which really ended up saving my life in high school. But but beyond that, you know, he's one of the inspirations for me to become a writer. And
me too.
You know, half the time I'm reading one of his stories, and I'm like, oh, I have a great idea. I mean, it's just so stimulating to read his work. I have to stop and go write something down, and then. Actually, I was reading Tlan yesterday, rereading it for like the 10th time, and I got an idea and I started writing it down. And 15 minutes later, I was like, "Wait a minute! I should probably get back to reading the story." So, he managed to be profound but inviting at the same time, and I think that separates him from a lot of other writers. Who are profound but condescending, or profound but snobby, basically. So that, you know, showing me that possibility was really eye opening. So
wonderful.
Yeah. So.
Well, so let's narrow down our focus a bit and talk about the first of our stories which is, of course, Tlon.
Which I'm pretty sure all of us invoked in our little stories.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's the first one in Labyrinth, I do believe.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So it's the first one that I ever read.
Excellent.
And usually when I tell people that, they're like, oh, and you kept reading? But...
But
yeah, who can actually briefly summarize the story for listeners?
I'll take a stab at it because I've been trying to do it all day, and I had to explain it a little bit to my mom this afternoon because I'm still trying to get her to read Borges. She's the one that got me into sci-fi and fantasy, and I try to return the favor whenever I can, but and I actually found my English copy because mostly what I have are in Spanish because that's how I taught myself Spanish. Was I decided, okay, I'm gonna get these stories that I love and I'm gonna get them in Spanish, and I'm gonna see if I can teach myself to read Spanish that way. Meh, kind of. Anyway, so Talon Ukbar Orbis Tertius is the story of a man's discovery of not one, but kind of three imaginary worlds. Would you say that's accurate? Mm-hmm. First, he encounters Ukbar via a pirate copy of the Encyclopedia Britannica, which most copies of it don't have the entry, but some of them do. And the only reason he comes across it is because his friend Bioy Casares, who that's his first Tuckerization, by the way, but I don't want to get on a tangent, but I mean, Adolfo Bioy Casares and he even wrote a movie together, which if you've ever seen it, it's wonderful. Mm-hmm. But his friend quotes or paraphrases the idea that mirrors and copulation are abominable because they increase the number of men. And oh, that's just profound. Where did you get it? Well, I saw it in this entry about this country called Ukbar. And he has to go through some effort to find it, finds it. Ukbar is supposedly, this is the first fictional country. It's supposedly in Asia Minor, somewhere around Iraq and Turkey. And the next bit that's important there is that it had a unique literature, and its literature was only fantasy literature. And its literature was about two places, something that starts with an M that you never hear of again, and Tlon, which is an imaginary planet that I always now picture as looking like the Fantastic Planet from that French animated film.
Right.
Prove me wrong, guys. Prove me wrong. And so that there's a whole literature about this imaginary world, and or supposedly, for all he knows, it's just some Borges type who just tossed off the idea that there is one and then moved on to something else. But later on, he finds that there's actually an encyclopedia of Tlon. Mm-hmm. And it goes into everything, especially about the idiosyncrasies of its language and its culture. And then he discovers a third layer of imaginary world in that a group of people that we can discuss later decided to try and write that whole encyclopedia in one of the languages of Tlon, and that's how we get Orbis Tertius. And when we get to Orbis Tertius, we slowly come to the realization that Orbis Tertius, which translates from the Latin into third planet or third globe, is maybe Earth. And all of the imagination that's gone into creating Tlon and Ukbar and Orbis Tertius is exercising enough power on the quote-unquote real world to be slowly transforming Earth into Tlon. How's that?
That's pretty good.
Yep.
That's pretty good. It's not an easy story to condense because...
Woo! I need a drink.
Because it's not really a story. I mean, in the sort of the standard sense. There was a recently an interview with Ursula Le Guin where she was talking about conflict and you know, she basically said conflict is, you know, not the only way to write a story. That's what we're used to. We're used to, like, what is the central conflict of your novel? And, you know, and she said, well, you know, there are other ways to do it than that. And Borges is one of the greatest examples of how to do stories without conflict. I mean, all the stories we have, except maybe one, which is part of the Garden of Forking Paths, there's no conflict. Right?
Right.
It's just, you know, they're more stories of discovery.
There's barely plot.
Yes.
Like,
yes, exactly.
Like, I mean, we have all of these things in T'lon, but it's not as though you would say something happened and then something else happened, except very, very infrequently.
Right.
It's more a conversation. You know, this guy's telling a story around a bar or something.
He really is. And then digressing.
Oh, yep. But that's part of the fun.
The digression and then the digression. It is, in that sense, really, really artfully told.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's easy on first reading to not see the design behind it, I think. Because of that conversational level, I think.
And I just realized, actually, yeah, there's a fourth layer of world building or creation in this. When you get down to the... I'm going to say this wrong because I don't know the language, but Hronir?
Right. Oh, yeah. Yep. Yeah.
Yep.
And that's where I really thought of Fantastic Planet, because I can totally picture those aliens, you know, all looking for a pencil and just looking so hard that their mind power makes the pencil appear and everyone comes up with a slightly different pencil.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And that is kind of maybe how that creation energy would start affecting the real world, because everyone has a different idea of what a pencil is.
Right. No, that was, I mean, I think it took me 3 or 4 readings to pick up on that. But, you know, Hronir is really important for the story, quote unquote.
And for most of Borges.
Right, yeah. I think that's one of the great things about T'lon as well, is that it's a great primer for all of Borges' fiction.
Yes,
because you will understand what to expect.
Yeah,
in future stories.
I feel like it is almost always, and there's plenty of Borges' work that I haven't read, but everything I've read, I find it really easy to say, this connects to a thing in T'lon. And I can't always connect two stories, but I feel like you can connect every story back to something that's happening in T'lon. Because notions of infinity, notions of trying to find the Platonic ideal, or I'm borrowing Plato, I don't know that it would necessarily be the Platonic ideal. But I feel like so many of the themes that come up elsewhere are found in T'lon. And that maybe some of the other stories are a little bit more focused on saying, I'm going to explore just this little piece of that. You know, I mean, especially in the ones that we read for today, I think of Circular Ruin and Library of Babel as saying, I'm going to take a piece and really poke at it. Whereas T'lon seems to have, there's so much. There's so much.
There is an easier capsule entry into Borges, and that's one of his poems. Jonah, have you ever read any of his poetry?
I don't think I have.
Oh, okay. So there's one in Spanish. It's El Amenazado. I think it translates to the threatened one. But take a look at it sometime, and it's pretty much a checklist of all things Borgesian.
Okay.
And it's all about a guy who's like, ah, crap, I'm in love. How do I get out of this? And he just like lists all of the things that he does and thinks about to avoid the fact that, ah, crap, I'm in love. So it's a total little. You know, I mean, even down to his fixation all those years with Anglo-Saxon poetry, I mean, everything he's been obsessed with is in there, and just this cute little poem. So look at that sometime. But so for a true beginner, I would start him with that poem, and then maybe, yeah, T'lon. Mm-hmm. And then after that, wow, I just realized we're doing Borges fractals or something. He'd like that.
He would.
He would like that a lot.
Sure would.
Fred, I wanted to ask you,
yep.
Especially, you are also a big Douglas Hofstadter fan. Do you ever find yourself thinking of Gerda Lescher Bach while you read Borges stories?
Oh yeah, I mean, if not go to Letcherbach, then aspects of it. Like, I mean, it's odd that you look at all the Penguin editions, about half of them have Escher covers for Borges collections. And, you know, you listen to certain pieces by Bach, and you find in music similar world building, you know, very, very simple things that become infinite combinations.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at some of Bach's variations on a theme, where he just takes the same couple of notes and extends it over like 60 minutes of music. You know, Borges does the same thing with just a little bit of fiction.
Yeah. So I think here he starts out, you know, if you start from the inside and build back out, he starts with Hrungnir, right, which is like the lowest or the deepest level of creativity in the story. And then he worked outward until he got to the Anglo-American Cyclopedia and his poor hapless hero trying to find out the origin of this offhand remark by his friend. So, yeah, you could spend hours going back and forth with that.
Yep. Yeah, and that coupling of whimsy with profundity is actually a very effective way to keep the reader's attention and also to get them thinking. So since he really sidesteps the trap of realism, he's not trying to convince you that this is, you know, real in some sense.
Yeah, or he's trying to convince you that reality is just a giant Hrungnir. I found the passage I was thinking about earlier. Virtually spur-of-the-moment projects are preferred. The systematic production of Hrungnir, says Volume 11, Volume 11 of the Tuan Encyclopedia,
which has is been the only volume.
Right. Spoilers. The systematic.
Wait, are we doing spoiler alerts for Borges?
Okay.
Why not?
The systematic production of Hrungnir has been of invaluable aid to archaeologists, making it possible not only to interrogate, but even to modify the past, which is now no less plastic, no less malleable than the future. And that's kind of summing up a little passage where they did these experiments with people who didn't know they were part of the experiment, just seeing if they can create things. And one of them created a torso with an inscription that has yet to be deciphered. And so the idea is maybe even all the artifacts that we've got in our museums. Ooh.
Well, but also just...
Somebody made those up too.
To the extent that history is making up stories about fragments. I mean, Hrungnir are... They are this wonderful notion, and there's so much, like, I find them delightful and wonderful and echoes and but also, I mean, it's a literalized metaphor of what do historians do, you know? And in fact, historians get around and they say, I'm going to collect this evidence and throw out a little bit of it, and then I'm going to tell my story, and someone else comes along and says, I'm going to take slightly different evidence, and I'm going to tell my story, and we can sort of hit each other over the head with our two competing stories based on kind of similar evidence that we are imagining to have some significance. I mean, in that sense, the way that the Hrungnir are both this fun thing that you can discover because it turns out that when you're looking for stuff, you tend to find it, which is another interesting kind of real world thing that happens, that when you're paying attention for something, you tend to notice it more.
And it's always in the last place you looked.
Yes. But just like you can read, I think, the whimsy in Borges, and also it is kind of relevant. I mean the notion that history is permeable and you can change it based on discoveries is kind of a thing that historians do, given that a lot of what historians are doing is worrying about their contemporary situation and trying to find echoes of it in the past.
Right.
Or the future. For all of the science fiction authors who are writing about the future but really writing about their own
right,
time.
The present.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, it was funny when I read that passage now that Kate's brought it back up. I just thought after reading that, that is the entire history of archaeology right there.
Yeah.
You know, like the gold mask. It's like, oh, this is clearly ceremonial. No, 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 it's a work of art. No, 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 it's pleasure
armor.
Mask, you know? Armor, yeah, exactly.
Well, and didn't we just recently find the statue of Ozymandias?
I believe I heard that.
I think the statue that of course everyone now only associates with that poem has been found in Egypt.
That's because they willed it into existence.
That's right.
Right. So then another writer that we talk about a lot in the same breath as Borges, because I know Le Guin even called him our own homegrown Borges, Philip K. Dick. So something that turns up in all of his stories, Kipple. Now, it's always kind of a melancholy thought, but what is Kipple except for Hronir that someone kind of failed at?
That's good. I like that.
Yeah, Kipple for people who haven't read Philip K. Dick, although those of you, how are you listening to this podcast? But anyway.
I have not read much Philip K. Dick.
Oh, I envy you.
I'm a
terrible
sci-fi fan.
No, you are a lucky sci-fi fan.
That's right.
I'm like rationing my Philip K. Dick because I know there's a finite amount, so there's still a bunch that I haven't let myself read yet. But anyway, Kipple is his made-up word for all of the kind of detritus that you find at the bottom of your purse. You know, all the grainy little stuff, the leftover. It's not quite trash. Some of it might still be kind of useful. There might even still be useful objects, but they're at the end of their life. It's not quite garbage, but, you know, or I'm still unpacking after moving house, which is why I'm on my crappy microphone instead of my good one. And I'm getting down to the kipple. And that's why all of a sudden I'm not unpacking very fast. But yeah. Failed Hromir, Kipple.
I mean, there's other similarities with Philip K. Dick in that, you know, the reality bending in this story can be seen in a lot of Dick's works.
Yes. You
know, or, and then a weird peripheral thing. I mean, Borges did several reviews of fake books, not in this collection, or in these stories, but in other collections where he reviewed fake books, and he kind of does the sort of thing in this story. Kate, you ever read a book called The Cardboard Universe?
No.
I forget the author, but it is a review of about 100 books written by an author that you will recognize as being Philip K. Dick, but is not. It's like, you know, the name, I think the initials are still PKD, but it's not Philip K. Dick. And The Cardboard Universe is this critical review of the 100 bad novels by this guy. So it kind of echoes with what Borges does and people like Stanislaw Lem did. John, maybe two collections?
Phoebus K. Dank?
Yeah, that's the one. Yes.
I had a dream like that once. I had a dream. I was in my dad's garage, and my dad doesn't even read fiction, so it was really weird. And I found a box full of paperback Philip K. Dick novels that I'd never heard of before. And I was all excited because it was like a treasure trove of like 30, and no one had ever heard of them before. And that's because they only exist in like Morpheus's library.
Well, yeah, I was going to say it's...
So I dreamed the Cardboard Universe once, apparently.
Yep, you were in Morpheus's library, which is adjacent to the Garden of the Forking Paths.
Forking Paths, so. Yep.
Right.
Man, that was the saddest wake-up of my entire life.
Yes.
They were even particular editions. Those editions from the 90s, trade paperbacks. I think Viking put them out. It was all those covers, too. It was so detailed. Wow. Very Borgesian.
Yep.
I could have maybe stayed asleep and read them.
So what else of this story? Any particular favorite passages? I can cite a few if you want.
Go.
Well, it just in the second paragraph, Bioy Cesares had come to dinner at my house that evening, and we had lost all track of time in a vast debate over the way one might go about composing a first-person novel whose narrator would omit or distort things and engage in all sorts of contradictions, so that a few of the book's readers, a very few, might divine the horrifying or banal truth. I mean, how many times does that show up again and again in his stories or other people's stories?
Mm-hmm.
Or another one I love is where he describes the Herbert Ash, the engineer, who has that volume 12 of the encyclopedia delivered to him shortly before he dies.
Mm-hmm.
Says, my father had forged one of those close English friendships with him. The first adjective is perhaps excessive. That begins by excluding confidences and soon eliminate conversation. Describes so many friendships that my father had.
I had myself about half convinced last year that Herbert Ash was the inspiration for Tim Powers' William Ash Bliss. And Tim Powers and Blaylock, is that the other one that wrote about William Ash Bliss?
Yes.
Do you guys, John and Jonas, do you guys read Tim Powers?
No.
Oh. Nope. Well, it's a very Borgesian idea. Also, Tim Powers is a poet that Tim Powers and his friend James Blaylock made up. They made up a biography for him. Except weirdly, he's one of the 19th century romantic poets. Except, which book is it, Fred, where there's one of his poems that's obviously 20th century?
Anubis Gates, maybe?
No, Anubis Gates is where he's kind of a character almost.
Yeah.
But one of his poems is quoted in another one, and it's something with obvious 20th century references, like motorcycles or something. I want to say maybe Earthquake Weather or something.
Possibly.
But they created a whole biography for this guy, and they both referred to him kind of obliquely in their works. And then in the Anubis Gates, they went ahead and Tim Powers made one of his characters basically live William Ash Bliss's later life. Very cool. But so yeah, Herbert Ash, William Ash Bliss. Prove me wrong. Go ahead.
We'll get going, Fred.
I'm not going to prove her wrong.
Right. And then
because it probably is connected.
Another obvious, you know, that first passage you read, Fred, about coming up with the unreliable narrator. I'm pretty sure Gene Wolfe took that as a dare. I'll show you, buddy.
Yeah, I mean so for everybody who does know, she's talking about the Book of the New Sun.
Yeah.
In particular, and that is just chock full of similarities in, like, I find, like, the writing style, the narrator there, the way he talks, but also there's a library in the book. The first book, I don't think the librarian is named after Borges. Yes.
No, he's not. He's, oh, crap. I've only done an entire series of blog posts about it. Let me look at his name.
But is he blind? Is that the...
He is blind.
Okay, so you
get... The librarian is blind.
Blind librarian. Should we jump the conversation a little wider and talk about authors who echo Borges or what?
Sure, why not?
Well, I'm bowing towards our host.
That'll get big, but sure. I mean... That, I mean, yeah, that's you know, that's a whole nother topic in some ways. But thinking about that point of, you know, inspiration and just how widely Borges has influenced people. I mean, Gene Wolfe, the Book of the New Sun in particular, is a good catch. But you know, when you think about a lot of work that does this, not non-linear, but sort of non-plotted, sort of, you know, kind of action, you can really cast your net pretty wide. I mean, who comes to mind? I mean, like I said, some of Le Guin's work comes to mind. It strikes me that The People Who Walk Away from Momelas has a Borgesian quality to it. Because in the end, what's happened is there's this, you know, this interpretation that may not relate to the real world, but the people are steadfastly adhering to, regardless of the cost. But also the style in that story, I find particularly has echoes of Borges in it. But I think of, you know, American experimental writers, like, to some extent, like Donald Bartlome, and, you know, how much did Borges sort of egg along that direction? You know, I mean, you know, some people cite James Joyce and some of his work as the inspiration for that, but certainly Borges also, I think, really stimulated that with his relative success. I mean, you know, it's funny to talk about how well known Borges is, but for a long time he wasn't very well known. I think it wasn't until, like, after Perón got tossed out of Argentina that he started to become better known. And then as he was able to travel more, I think that helped spread it too. And also his sort of global approach to things in his work too. Like, you know, his settings were often not pinned down necessarily. They were like a lot of things in his book, sort of like made up places.
He's got that wonderful quote about Ukbar very early on. Exhausted all of the imaginable spellings. Before leaving, he told me it was a region of Iraq or Asian Minor. I must confess I agreed with some discomfort. And he spent some more time on sort of the ways in which Ukbar is recognizably this sort of vague area of the world that so many people have only vague notions of, and therefore you could put almost anything in there. Because it's funny that it is funny to me that the response that you guys are having to Borges is, who else, where can we see the echoes of Borges? Whereas, and in particular, what later authors can we see? Because he's, and again, it's in Tlan, because sort of everything about Borges, or so many of the things about Borges in Tlan, he's got the line late on, the critics invent authors. They select two dissimilar works, the Tao Te Ching and the Thousand One Nights, attribute to them the same writer, and then determine most scrupulously the psychology of this interesting homme de lettres. And I happen to have the Pooh Perplex in Postmodern Pooh, so parody critiques of modern and postmodern critics, but like, I just, Borges is, for me, it's like he's showing me what are secondary world fantasists doing when they're creating another world. What are the science fiction authors who are saying, let me play with this one physical or chemical idea, or this notion of getting really big or really small, and let me poke at physics and how they work, or what What about the I mean, I feel like sometimes it happens in comics and sometimes it happens in science fiction and sometimes in movies where people are sort of striving to encompass God in some way in the infinite, and whether it's, what was it, Contact? That was one of the movies that tried to do it. And I feel like there was another one recently. But all of those, either the idea of let's take one idea and really extrapolate it, or let's sort of poke at a plethora of possibilities.
Mm-hmm.
I see those echoes, and in so many ways, I feel like Borges makes me able to enjoy those more. He influenced all of them.
Right.
Or at least he influenced how I read all of them, and isn't that in some ways the same thing?
Right. No, absolutely. I mean, hearing you talk about that, it occurs to me as like, are they, you know, influenced, or do we just see the influence? Has Borges, you know, sort of retrained us to look at stories in a different way? And, you know, like the Hrønir, we see something a little different about that story than other people may have before us.
Another thing that's really fun about Borges, and it kind of gets back to what I was talking about at the beginning, is tracing the sources of the ideas that he played with or things that he refers to. Mm-hmm. So kind of my first ever exposure to Islamic mysticism or any kind of really Islamic theology started partly, at least, right here. Early on, there's that offhand reference to the Night of Nights.
On one particular Islamic night, which is called the Night of Nights, the secret portals of the heavens open wide, and the water in the water jars is sweeter than on other nights. If those gates had opened as I sat there, I would not have felt what I was feeling that evening.
Yeah. So that's gorgeous, and I've never traced like where he got that imagery, but it made me real curious about what the heck this Night of Nights was. And, you know, that's a night in Ramadan. Do you guys know about the Night of Qadr?
No.
I'll admit to only knowing about Ramadan and nothing more narrow.
Okay. Well, Ramadan is basically, you know, the holy month in Islam. Mm-hmm. And the Night of Qadr is the night that the first verses of the Quran were transmitted to Muhammad. And so it's the holiest of all the nights of Ramadan. And it's very special. Like, if you stay up all night and pray, all of your sins will be forgiven. You know, pray and study the Quran. Because that one night is equivalent to, I forget the math, but it's equivalent to 44 months or something ridiculous. It comes out to like 83 years worth. So if you pray that one night, it's as if you prayed consistently for 83 years. And so you're really, really, that's the best night to pray. Problem is, you don't know which night it is. There's clues that narrow it down. It's an odd numbered night in the last 10 nights of Ramadan. And there's been disputation over it and ideas of how to figure it out, and different factions and sects within Islam have different ideas of how to figure out which night it is. But there's no definitive, it's this night, guys. It's not like Christmas or something where we're like, this is the night. It's just, you've got a ballpark. So, you know, that's totally the sort of thing that would absolutely, now, as much as we know Borges now, that's exactly the sort of thing that would turn him on. It turns me on. It made me way more interested in that whole religion. It all started with that offhand little remark right there. Mm-hmm. Just like is mentioned in the Library of Babel about the idea of, and I always get it wrong, it's Bishop Berkeley's idea about God being a circle whose circumference is everywhere and center is nowhere, or I might have it backwards now. My Kindle battery just died.
The library has it as the center of the library is wherever you are, and the circumference is, what is it, immeasurable? Yeah. I can't quite remember. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But so reading back and tracing that idea, that was a fun little sophomore year project too. Mm-hmm. So if you're not lucky like I was and end up inheriting a complete library of all of the issues of the Horizon magazine from the 60s to be your liberal arts education, I think you could probably start with Borges.
You know, I may have to do that with the small child when she grows up a little bit. At about 12 or 13, just, all right, here you go.
Here's Borges.
Here's Borges. Pick a story, find all the references, and track them down.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, one of my favorite books, and this is only tangentially related, but it is very Borgesian, Otsog, On the Shoulder of Giants, which is this incredibly humorous academic text tracking down Newton's If I Have Seen Farther Than Others, it is because I have stood on the shoulders of giants, that just goes down every possible academic rabbit hole in sort of trying to figure out where did this come from and where else could it have come from and where else, you know, who has said this is why it is cited. And many of the same pleasures I get from reading Borges are pleasures I get from reading Otsog, because...
Spell that for me.
My memory is the title is actually On the Shoulders of Giants. I think the author is Merton, Merton, but he of course abbreviates it Otsog, Otsog. But it is just this, like, I'm pretty sure that he's not making up any of his references, that it is in fact accurately footnoted and cited. But, like, it's, you know, 150 pages of tracking down the source of this one quote and everywhere it's ever been cited to and explaining what's going on. And that feels like an exercise that would either be described in one of Borges's stories or at least one that would have delighted him.
Wait, it's called the Shandian Postscript?
Yes.
As in Tristram Shandy?
Yes.
Oh my God. I might be over at the Amazon page about to click buy.
I've read it two or three times now, and it's just like, if you like reading, you know, sort of pseudo-academic erudition without, where you don't actually have to follow the argument, you just have to kind of enjoy footnotes and the ways that authors take pot shots at each other and, you know, go down weird rabbit holes because they can, it is the ideal of that sort of writing. I feel like some of that pleasure also comes through in some of what Borges is doing.
And I think this is something I could go on and on about, especially with the way that Jonah sort of rephrased the possibility of influence. Where I read so many authors before where I would think, oh, that's a little Borgesian, or wow, that's, you know, did that come from Borges, or, you know, stuff like that. Even in my academic career, I came across books that you know, probably weren't actually influenced by Borges, but they had a Borgesian quality. There's an anthropologist named Michael Taussig, whose earlier work certainly felt very Borgesian to me, because he didn't select, you know, fact and history above mythology or, you know, or local custom or local stories. They all existed on sort of the same plane, and the question was, how do they relate to each other and what reality do they produce? And, you know, that's, I think, as Borgesian as an anthropologist can probably get. And it was real. And again, you know, the great thing is when I sort of say that to myself when I'm reading something, it's usually because it's doing to me what Borges does to me.
Yes. Yes.
You know what I mean?
It is that flash of recognition. Mm-hmm. This is triggering exactly the same kind. Like, There's the in Tlon, there's the passage about language. No nouns in Tlon's conjectural Urs Baka, right. From which the present language is. And at the end of that, he sort of talks about language. And I was a really bad student of both Latin and Old English. But then he says at the end, the moon rose above the river is literally upward behind the on-streaming it mooned.
Yep.
And
I'm the only one that laughed at mooned in my class at Bard when we got to that passage.
Well, I feel like at the very best of times, when I was really prepared for my language classes, I could both kind of get what was being said in Beowulf or whatever it was that I was translating, and also I could kind of get the ways that the words worked in that language. But I have the sense that if you were really good at another language, which he clearly was, there's mm-hmm. probably even more pleasure and joy to be derived. And again, a sort of moment of recognition of what does it mean to be reading and to recognize both how to translate this and also, I mean, upward behind the on-streaming it mooned. That is a delightful sentence for about three different reasons, you know, and to be able to see that in a second language. And of course, this was originally written in Spanish, right?
Yeah. Which,
so again, like that, there's so many layers and there are so many different points to just be delighted. And I feel like
my Spanish language copy is right here, so I'm gonna look at what that bit says in Spanish, but I've got to take off my headset for a second.
Yeah,
I'll be back.
And that's actually something I wanted to talk about. This was how important the translator is to the process. There's Homer, to kind of go back to Ulysses, but a different Ulysses. Yeah, there's many, many, many translations of Homer, but I forget, it was like 1990 something or other that Fagles came out with his version.
Right.
And it brought kind of like a renaissance to it. And the same could be said for Borges. You know, how important a translator is to the work, or a specific translator. Mm-hmm. Like Echo, I always enjoy the translations by one particular guy for Umberto Echo. And I think most of my Borges is done by Andrew Hurley. So, wonder how crucial that is to enjoying it.
Yeah, I kind of
probably
wonder,
pretty crucial.
But I wonder, because thinking back over the Borges I've written, it's been translated by a number of different people. Actually, my version of Labyrinth has several different translators working on the stories. At the bottom of each story, it says who it was translated by.
Yep.
And I have yet to detect a poor translation, as far as I can tell. I mean, I've read a couple of translators of other Spanish and Russian authors that they're just not good. Like, I've read some early Bulgakov translations that are horrible.
Oh, God, yes.
You know, and, you know, there's one particularly inexorable Tolstoy's War and Peace out there that I almost threw away because it was so unreadable. But I've read a fair amount of Borges, and I haven't found a lot of that I am aware of.
Mm-hmm. The funny thing is, the books I have right here, Hurley is listed on one... 2, 3, 4 of them just on, 5 of them are just on the cover. Mm-hmm. So probably listed inside as well. Right. So I think the Wikipedia mentions that his, I think it was his secretary who was his executor.
I believe that's correct.
Like canceled the contracts to be able to republish all earlier translators of, and I think Hurley was the one that she preferred. Mm-hmm. But did you find what you were looking for, Kate? Or
I did, and it's four words. Are you ready for this? This is beautiful. Uva tras perflue luno. So it's basically saying the same thing. Perflue is kind of upstreaming, but I just love that actually he just turned the Spanish word for the moon into a verb, luno. It mooned. So it worked, it's almost an exact translation of what he did in Spanish.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Nice.
That is wonderful. By the way, might be the worst way to learn Spanish that if anyone ever came up with, just because of tricks like that. So I can read Borgesian Spanish, or maybe, you know, Argentinian literary Spanish, but regular Spanish, I'm kind of a doofus.
I don't know. I had a professor at one point who told me that his favorite language to learn was Greek, because with Greek, he got to read Homer.
Right.
And everything else,
I did that.
It was much more boring. And with Greek, he at least stuck with it. Like, he was at least interested in what he was learning.
I liked Homer in the original until I found the Chapman translation, though. And I like the George Chapman translation even better than the original Greek.
Now,
it's like this wonderful Shakespearean English and English scansion poetry. Oh, it's great.
Kate, I don't know how much you heard when we were speculating on how much the translator matters to Borges, but I suspect you are the one of us who could opine the most on how much Borges's Spanish matters when being translated. Do you know? Are there?
I've never paid that much attention to who the translator was in my English editions, because I'm a bad, lazy intellectual. I mean, I'm not a real intellectual.
I never really have either. Yeah.
So that might be a subject for another Borges cast, and I'll do some more looking. But just based on that little passage, mm-hmm. you know, where he brought our favorite sentence down into even pithier Spanish, and just did the exact same thing. He verbed the noun. I'm thinking maybe not. I don't know. I will look more into that for next time, because I think that's probably worth an answer that's better than I could give now.
Gotcha.
Wah, wah, wah.
Well, I think on that note, we should start winding down.
Because if we don't cover the other stories.
Well, I had a feeling when we put the story list together that it was ambitious to consider them all in one. I mean, yeah, but just, yeah.
Who's the first that has to compile the show notes?
That would be me.
Oh, Freddy.
Yeah.
I'll help you if you need.
So, yeah, I mean, I think this conversation shows there's a lot more to talk about. And, you know, one of the really interesting things about Borges is how much he stimulates conversation. But it occurs to me, this is one of the sort of the most joyous discussions we've had on the podcast. Which is great. I mean, it's what's really enjoyable for me is not just hearing people talk about Borges, but in the terms we've talked about him in, which it's just not about, you know, the story. It's about all the things that we gain from reading him. And I like that angle a lot. Mm-hmm. I hope when we talk about subsequent stories, we can hold on to that.
We can. And there's so much more that we haven't even hit yet, because for people that haven't read Borges and listened to this, they might think that he's just a crazy idea guy, but he wrote stories that have more of a plot and that have more conflict, you know, like Themes of the Traitor and the Hero, and even Three Versions of Judas, and the screenplay that he and Casares wrote for Invasion. I mean, those are all full of conflict and misunderstanding and betrayal and
right?
You know, he could plot when he wanted to. He just didn't always bother.
Right. And he and Casares actually wrote some mystery stories together.
Yeah. And then Casares, I think, wrote a bunch more films, too. But, yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, he can. Yeah. But it's...
Oh, and we could talk about Casares' story, The Invention of Morrell. Oh, God, yeah. Oh, God, yes. So, this better not be the last Borges cast.
I would like it to not be the last Borges cast. I would like to be the first of many.
Woohoo! You
indeed.
Know, the Garden of Forking Borges podcasts. So yeah, let's wrap it up for now.
Okay.
And we'll make culture consumed. Don't forget that.
Right.
Oh. I sorry, I was confused.
And I will talk with Jeff, but let's get something from our panelists.
Let's get something out of them.
Right.
All right. So what besides Borges have you been reading, Kate?
Or writing.
I am probably best known on the internet for my sonnets. And originally, I just dared myself to write a Shakespearean sonnet every day for 2 years about whatever subject came to mind. And I published a collection of those previously, and that got too easy. So then I decided to challenge myself more. Once you've got the formula down, it's really, I can write a sonnet in like 5 minutes. It's not necessarily a good one, but it would obey all of the formal and metrical and rhyme scheme requirements of a Shakespearean sonnet. But it might be about complete and utter drivel. But then I've decided to move on to writing narrative sonnets and writing a short story every day in sonnet form. And I set myself a schedule of genres. So like, and they're nice and alliterative. So Mystery Monday and Western Wednesday and, you know, Sci-Fi Saturday and all of that. And I just published the first collection of those. It's called Pulp Sonnets.
Oh.
And, it's got a beautiful cover by Scott Pond and really cool illustrations by M.R. Nino, who is a great comics artist from Ohio that I'm a big fan of. And so that came out in January, published on the day that 45 got inaugurated, so it hasn't gotten as much attention as I hoped. But it's available from Amazon in either paperback or ebook. And I'm about to do a book release party in my hometown in about 2 weeks. So that's the writing. And as for reading, I just finished the fifth Expanse novel, James S.A. Corey. It was my favorite one of the bunch because it gave all of the characters of the crew of the Rocinante, speaking of Don Quixote and Jorge Luis Borges, gave them all things to do and stories, and so it's my favorite. And then also just recently I finished very interesting Henry James novel that doesn't get talked about much anymore called Princess. My Italian is terrible. Princess Casa Massima, which is kind of the story of how a young English bookbinder is radicalized by his contact with the upper class, but it's not by the means that you think. It's because the members of the upper class that he encounters are interested in socialism. And he gets caught in the middle of a guy trying to impress this Italian princess. She's very into socialism, and this stupid English dilettante is just trying to impress her. And so she says, "Bring me some working class yabos, bring me some scum, bring me some poor people." And the bookbinder gets caught up in that and winds up, it's kind of a precursor to Conrad's The Secret Agent, where you've got another hapless would-be terrorist created by circumstances he doesn't understand. And it's Henry James. And it was very, very readable. Because, you know, Henry James kind of exhausts most modern readers with his page-long sentences. And
I know James only by reputation, and when you said very, very readable, I got very, very confused.
This is my pet theory about it is it's maybe from before he got a lady with a typewriter to take from dictation, and when he had to do the work himself, he kept his sentences shorter. That's just my invented theory from a while ago. I read a history of typewriting called The Iron Whim, which is a lot about the effect of the invention of the typewriter on literature. And so it's a lot about Henry James and his various typewriter coolies. So there you go.
Typewriter coolies.
These poor women. I can just picture him just standing over them. He's like, did you get that right? You know, and it's been, he's barely taken a breath in like 700 words and it's all one sentence. Oh, you misplaced the semicolon there. Type it again.
Oh boy.
So Jonah. Yeah, Jonah, what have you been reading?
So I started my year with Hild and Underground Railroad, both of which I really enjoyed. Hild kind of died off a little bit for me at the end, but it's a really powerful just work of imagination. And as an Anglo-Saxonist who had to translate the passage about the sparrow flying out of the winter and into the king's hall and then back out of the feasting hall again, getting to see that scene in a novel was a lot of fun. I was amazed by Underground Railroad, which is deserving of all of the plot it's getting, and I would like to see it getting genre awards because it's very much a genre novel. I heard someone say something about how the speculative aspect is the titular Underground Railroad, and the speculative aspect goes a lot more than that and is about taking ideas and responses of white America towards black America and kind of pushing them and taking little ideas that have been tried on small scales and making them on big scales. And that feels like a lot of science fiction novels I've read. It was really good. And then I dipped over to space opera and I, in short succession, read Nine Fox Gambit and A Matter of Oaths. And I feel like both of them were doing kind of similar things. And Nine Fox Gambit was a little slow in the middle for me and ended really well. And A Matter of Oaths pulled me through the middle, but did not end quite as well. And I'm trying to sort of sort out in my heads what was going on with both of those and why they feel so connected to me. And another thing I'm trying to sort out in my head, having read the first issue of Faya magazine, which has a collection of stories, all of which I kind of enjoyed and which felt really cohesive, got me thinking about just short story collections in general and the editorial voice of the collection versus individual stories, because I came into reading spec fic short stories with Long Hidden, where it was like after each story I had to just put it down because there was so much going on and each one of them was like a punch in the gut. And then more recently, the Faya, and also I read the Islamic Hates volume and actually reviewed that for Strange Horizons. And both of those, I feel like the way the stories work together enhance things. So another kind of set that I'm thinking about. And I have I'm doing a book club for the Cabbages and Kings podcast soon with a couple of the Shadow Clark jurors, although not Shadow Clark books. We are reading Stone Boatman, Watership Down, and Unbreakable Splendor by Sun Young Shin, which are not cohesive at all. We just each picked a book.
Yeah, I was trying to figure out.
There's no connection there beyond that.
Ow, my brain.
We each picked a book, but I think it's going to be an interesting discussion, and each of those books has been interesting to encounter or re-encounter in their own ways. So that's my fiction reading. That's my speculative reading.
I challenge you for that episode of Cabbages and Kings to find the Borges in all of those books. I'll be listening.
I will. I don't. I think that will actually be very easy, especially with Unbreakable Splendor and Stone Boatman. Both of those are experimental in ways that I think echoes, whether they are more distant echoes or closer echoes, I think Borgesian themes would be pretty easy to spot. And even Watership Down. I mean he's playing with the language that rabbits use in ways that, again, I think Borges might have approved of. So there's my preview of that one.
Excellent. All right. Well,
make us wait for the actual podcast to hear what culture you two are consuming.
Well, of course, that way we make you listen.
Like, that's, I wasn't right, gonna listen anyway.
I just fast forward until we get to culture consumed.
Yeah. Well, we will now reluctantly say goodbye to our guests, Kate Sherrod.
Sherrod, actually.
Sorry, Sherrod. You know what? I keep doing that. I'm sorry.
The easy way to remember it is to sing it. Kate Sherrod, Sherrod. The guys at Bard made up a whole song to it. Her middle name is Marie. She's shorter than you and me. Yeah. Every day at lunchtime, I'd walk into the cafeteria for 4 years, and I got a serenade.
Excellent.
What up, Zizix? I know you're listening.
And Jonas Sutton-Morse, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having us. This was a ton of fun.
Yep, thank you.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
I got to talk about Octavia Butler last time. So you guys are my favorite podcast to crash.
Uh-oh. Well, when 10th Planet comes out with their letters to Octavia, we'll have you back to talk about that.
There you go.
Please.
Oh, that the Butler book, by the way, that Modern Masters of Science Fiction one, is really good.
And, yes, it's quite good. I just
checking out if you haven't
finished
yet.
Reading it. Yeah, Jerry Canavan does a really good job.
Yeah,
discussing Butler. And neither being dryly academic nor theoretically opaque.
Right, and
I think
also he does a really good job of kind of giving the biography and context for Butler without dipping into voyeurism. Which felt like it, from what he says, it seems like that would have been an easy tack to take, and I am glad that he did not.
Yes, no, I got that impression as well. But that blending of the point in her life when she wrote certain things with the stories was, I thought that was very well done.
Yeah.
I don't think anyone in the series has done it that well yet.
It's my introduction to the series, so I assume that all of the other books will be ruined for me.
Spoiler alert.
I've already blown next month's and April's book budget, but yeah, I'm going to have to get that too. Yeah. I'm going to tell you one last piece of Kate Sherrod, Octavia E. Butler trivia that's just stupid, but it's funny. So to promote my book, I sponsored an episode of the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
Yep.
And it's just the way the dice came out. The next episode was during Black History Month, and they decided to redo Octavia Butler's Blood Child.
Mm-hmm.
So that wound up being the episode that I sponsored. Completely random. So
excellent.
And yeah, that was cool.
That's very cool.
Yeah.
Excellent. Well, thank you both very much for being here.
Thank you for having us.
And we will move on to more culture consumed.
Good night, guys.
All right.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Hey, where'd everybody go? I brought cake. Come on. I'm always showing up late for these things. Hey, everybody. Jeff Patterson here. Straggling into the end of another episode of Three Horsemen, and got a few culture consumed picks I want to talk about. Hi, Fred.
Hey, Jeff. Sorry you missed the conversation.
On? Yeah, so am I. Was really into that. Well, hopefully we'll do more.
Oh yeah, we will.
So I got to start this off on a downer note, because the day we're recording this is shortly after hearing about the death of Bernie Wrightson. And this one hit me hard. I know he retired in January, and I know he had had the brain surgery, and he had a few projects that were left unfinished. But you know, you can go online and find hundreds and hundreds of tributes to him right now by people who knew his work better than I did. But I just did want to point out one thing, and that was late 70s, as you know, my most formative years when it came to science fiction and the fantastic in general. Wrightson was part of what was called the Studio, which was the artist commune with Barry Windsor Smith and Catherine Jones, Jeff Jones at the time, and Michael Kaluta. And they had had a book that came out from Paper Tiger called Dragon's Den? Dragon's Dream, that Paper Tiger put out at the time, when they were doing lots of books by Roger Dean and Chris Achilleos and Bob Eagleton. And the work of those four artists in that book just so blew me away. And the fact that they all worked so long into their life. I mean, we lost Jones a couple of years ago, a few years ago, 2011, I think. And now we've lost Bernie Wrightson. And he's, you know, he had a lot of high profile things like obviously the illustrations for Frankenstein that he did for Marvel, and his Swamp Thing work, and of course Creepshow, the illustrations and the actual comic book adaptation that came out. But he also, you know, there was a lot of stuff he did. He did Witching Hour. He did the Fantastic Batman, the Cult miniseries. He did some Jonah Hex for a while. His work in Conan for Marvel, Doctor Strange, and Epic Illustrated. He did a few pieces for Epic Illustrated that were just mind-blowing. And he's one of those artists whose style is immediately recognizable. And just re-looking at those, you know, Frankenstein illustrations that have been up all over the internet is just one of those. You know, your breath actually catches when you see some of the detail and the use of negative space and the fact that he could make things look like woodcuts so easily, and the fact that he made these things, you know, render at such a level of detail that obviously inspired so many other people later on. So definitely had to pay a little tribute to him. That was a rough one to take. We also lost Jimmy Breslin today too, who I was always a fan of, even though I was never big into baseball. I was always into his political commentary. So one by one, they fall away and time goes on. So have a few books I want to talk about for Culture Consumed this week. A couple comic book related things. Number one, I just caught up with the 3 issues of Avatarx, which is written by Grant Morrison. The first 2 issues, the art is by Jeevan Kang, and the 3rd issue, Edison Manu George. This is a collection of a web series that he did for Graphic India. It sort of riffs on the same kind of superhero take of Hindu mythology that he did in the 18 Days book and the comic that came after. He obviously enjoys playing in this particular sandbox, and he does a pretty good job. And this book, the art is gorgeous, and the story is sort of over the top funny. The 3rd issue especially, I think, really delving into a bit of a science fiction-y territory. I'm interested to see where it goes. I never read these when they were online, so I want to follow this along and see where it goes. Avatarx, Destroyer of Darkness is the book, and it's by Graphic India. There's 3 issues out so far. Paul Cornell just started writing Vampirella with Jimmy Broxton doing the art, and that 1st issue was unmistakably a Paul Cornell story. A little bit of time travel, a little bit of steampunk, a little bit of all kinds of stuff thrown in there. All at once, just gorgeous to look at, and with a really, you know, Cornell's very good at unusual dialogue, and I was really rather pleased with the way this went. Some interesting narrative choices with some subtitles at the bottom of the page, similar to what's going on with Squirrel Girl, though not trying to be snarky, being much more informative. And a lot of neat stuff like interior design that Broxton is adding to the piece. So looking forward to this to see where it goes. First issue is really good. We are, I believe, 3 issues into Red Sonja by Amy Chu, where Red Sonja is in the present. And we are now finding out that Kulan Goth has been waiting for her. And Carlos Gomez is doing the art, and it's been really, really nice. Lots of swordplay in modern urban settings, and a lot of fun. Couple books I want to talk about real quick. Number one, Brian Catling took me completely by surprise by releasing a sequel to The Vor called Erstwhile. And I'm not only was I surprised by its release, but I was surprised by how good it was. I really liked the first Vor, which Mr. Stevens turned me on to. And the sequel falls into the category of what I refer to as the Phantom Tollbooth model of storytelling, where a character goes around and meets a number of very interesting, eclectic characters who each have an odd point to make before proceeding into the next bit of the story. And really, really solid work. I also read 2 anthologies that were edited by James Gates. One's from last year, and I think the other one's more recent. The first she co-edited with Monica Valentelli, and that was Upside Down, which is an anthology of stories where tropes are inverted. Mm-hmm. This had an essay by Mr. Patrick Hester, which I was unaware of. And I also noticed that the contents contain a number of people that we used to play with over at SF Signal.
That hack.
I'm about halfway through that book, and it's pretty solid so far. Most useful is the index of tropes inverted that shows up in the back. Which was a lot of fun to read. And the other one that Gates edited was Genius Loci, Tales of the Spirit of the Place. And I was rather, I don't want to say I was surprised by the quality of the stories in there, but the fact that they're as poignant as they are. I think I expected a different, more, I don't know, somewhat more flamboyant tone out of the book, and they're very, very poignant and lyrical, and I was really pleased with it. I think I've got 2 more stories left in that. Genius Loci, Tales of the Spirit of the Place, and I believe that came out last year. Solid work, really solid work. I don't get to read stuff she's edited all that much. So when it comes out, I'm always pleased to grab it. And the one other thing I wanted to mention was the latest issue of 1843, which is the magazine of ideas, lifestyle, and culture that The Economist puts out, I believe, every other month. The latest issue has an article by Mr. Alec Ash called Folding Meanings, which is pretty much an overview of what's going on in Chinese science fiction right now.
Oh, really?
And yeah, he starts off talking about Kix and Lu, but he goes on and brings up several other authors who I had either not heard of or who I had heard of and not really pursued. And now I am going to start pursuing them. He also, it's a very short piece. It's only 2 pages long, but he talks about some of the influences that these people had and what kind of stuff they wanted to express, and how young Chinese writers are using SF to criticize society, as well as get other points across regarding their view of the universe and other personal philosophies. And the fact that so much of what's being done in China right now is by its very nature, somewhat subversive, given how China's rather actively sort of try to clamp down on things like time travel and stuff like that in fictional works. So rather fascinating piece, and it was kind of neat to actually see it referenced in 1843 magazine, out of all places, which normally does not veer anywhere near the realm of science fiction. Yeah, so it's been, you know, a somewhat content heavy month, and I got a few things that I'm in the middle of, including a few new comics and stuff like that. But that's about all I have.
Do you listen to their podcasts at all?
Once in a while, I'll dig it up.
Well,
I haven't been doing that many nonfiction podcasts lately, just because there's been a few new shows on SiriusXM I've been listening to. So,
well, Mr. Ellis will be on the Economist podcast at some point.
Really?
Yep. In one of his morning computers, he mentioned that he was interviewed by, I think it's Kenneth Couquier, is one of their main podcasters. So I've been keeping an eye out for that. I'm sure he'll let us know.
Yes, I will definitely check in on that. So what have you been sticking your nose in?
Well, not too much since our last episode. I did read, I'm trying to ease my way out of the Project from Heck back into a normal life. Any month now, that'll end, and I'll be able to start reading more. So my morning commute, my evening commutes, I've been doing audiobooks, which is, you know, if I spend an hour sitting on Route 1, I might as well spend an hour on sitting on Route 1 listening to Paul Cornell or whoever. So I actually did read listen to a Paul Cornell, one of his, I think it's the, not sure if the series is called The Shadow Police, but it's his Supernatural London series. So the one I read was London Falling, which is the first of the series. And it was quite good. I mean, I really enjoyed, if you like Warren Ellis, if you like Tim Powers, if you like stuff like that, he like Warren Ellis with the Injection series and other stuff, or even Michael Moorcock with some of his stuff. He works Legends of London into, the story. So that was a good detective story. In a similar vein, I read Ben Aronovich, who has done some, I'm not sure what comics he's done. I know he's done some Doctor Who episodes. But he's got a series called Peter Grant, and the first one is called Midnight Riot in the U.S. I'm trying to remember. I'm not sure what it's called. I know it was called something different in England. But similar thing, except the Cornell story has got kind of like there was a supernatural detective agency, which the characters in the book kind of revive. This one, the Aronovich, there is a society which has fallen on hard times, which has a kind of an alliance with the police, and they do detective work when the supernatural leaks through. So the main character, Peter Grant, is brought on as the first novice in a long time for the society. Very good writing. I mean, I blew through both of them really quickly. And I'm going to, as soon as I cycle through a few more stories, I'm trying to switch between authors rather than burn through one series at a time. So as soon as I switch through a few more authors, I'm going to circle back to both of those and get the next installments in both. I think Peter Grant of the Aronovich series is up to like maybe 5 or 6 books, and Cornell, I think, has 3 entries, maybe a short story. And I'm not sure if his new one, which is coming out, I think, Tuesday of this week, Chalk. I'm not sure if that's linked to it or not.
Yeah.
But if that's as good as some of these, the Shadow Police, it's going to be an enjoyable read. I also read a book called 1632 by Eric Flint, which is another reread. That's either the Grantville series or the Ring of Fire series, in which a town in West Virginia is sent back in time to Europe in 1632, and they have to learn how to gear down in order to survive. So it's my goal to finally get through that series. I don't know how many books are in that series now, anthologies, novels, but it's time to get caught up because the pile is just too large. It's going to collapse and crush me one of these days.
Yeah.
And then
I hear that.
And then the other one that I read, again, it was a reread, but because I've got, I think, two entries in the series I haven't gotten to, was the Jennifer Morgue by Charles Stross, which is part of his...
Love that book.
Yeah, his laundry series, and this was his homage to Mr. Fleming and James Bond. Mm-hmm. So that was a fun listen. The author, or rather the narrator, they have on that one did a good job. In fact, all three of the narrators on all these books did a good job. I mean, the Cornell one was kind of the hardest one to get into initially, partly because he kind of throws you in the middle of the story, plus the accent of the narrator was a little hard. It's like, what's going on here? But, you know, about by the second chapter, I was thoroughly hooked. And the Peter Grant one, he had a very excellent narrator there as well. And that's about it for me.
Awesome. Well, then we will wrap up here, and we will have some stuff coming up in the next couple months.
Yep.
And we hope everybody that spring is kind to you.
Once the snow melts.
Right. All right. Everybody take care.
So, good night.